Welcome everybody to the Ideas to Innovations panel. I'm Patrick Trainer, the University of Florida. We appreciate your patience. It turns out that the weather has hampered us. Our backup panelist, or our replacement panelist, is also missing due to the weather. So we'll try to incorporate him as soon as he arrives. But in the meantime, we have two excellent panelists who are going to talk to us today about how you cross the chasm. How is it that you take those great ideas that you all work hard on in your labs and convert them into something that people are interested in buying, selling, using every day? So I'd like to introduce our two panelists today. Giovanni Vigna is a professor at UCSB, and he's the founder of Lastline. And Farnam Jahanian is the vice president of research at Carnegie Mellon, and the founder of Arbor Networks. So, gentlemen.
You go first.
You want? Go ahead.
Okay, I'll go for it.
You're sitting.
All right, I got to go first. Oh, there is a real system here. Can I actually?
Sure. Do you want to move this way a little bit?
Yeah. Just give me a sec. I got the connectors right. Much better. No, sure it's going to be.
Of course.
Okay. Just give me a second. Sorry. That's what happens when you have multiple virtual machines. You forget about it. Okay. Let's see if we can do it this time. And I will have to just go here. And can you guys see my pointer? Can you get me up, up, down, down? I have no idea where I am.
It's right there.
Oh.
Now you're
okay. And I need system preferences that opens, of course, in the wrong. God, I hate technology. It's getting here we go. Here we go. Displays, arrangement, mirror, thank you. Oh, that was painful. All right, here I am. I'm gonna stand up because it's very difficult for me to talk while I'm sitting. So as Patrick said, many of you know me, but for the ones who don't, I have around 15 minutes to do my introduction. So I'm a professor in computer science at UCSB. I worked on a number of different topics in security, vulnerability analysis, intrusion detection in the good old days when it was actually allowed. And I started malware research in around 2004, focusing especially on evasions, detecting evasive malware. And one thing that we did that I thought it was good and successful was to build systems that people would actually use. But instead of delivering the software for people to build on, we decided to use a different model where we would create portals, so web portals where people could come and use our tools. This allowed us to do two things. First of all, we got a lot of data from people, because they came and they submitted files and they sent us URLs to analyze and so forth. And we also learned a lot about maintaining a system that has to sometimes withstand this, the impact of a large population of people coming and banging at your door. And I want to hear the names are WebAwet, Revolver, Hulk. There is also Anubis, which I am claiming here as mine, but is actually developed by Chris Krugel and Engin Kurda. I'm just, stealing the name. But all this experience ended up, in a startup called Lastline that does anti-malware. And Chris Krugel, that is also a professor at UCSB, and Engin Kurda, who's a professor at Northeastern University, were the co-founders. We have been working together, doing research together forever. We're great friends, so it was a good match. So the company per se is VC-backed, so we got funding. I'll tell you all about it. We're now around 60 people,
We are PhD heavy to the point that somebody that we tried to hire recently was scared away, saying, you have too many PhDs. I don't think I can work in this environment. It must have been in a grad lab for too long. And the product that we came up with is something that's fundamentally observes an enterprise network, extract data from the network traffic, from events on the host, and put everything together with program analysis to determine which machines are infected. And it's, in a nutshell, our product. Interestingly, we didn't start with this product. We ended up going to this product. And I'll tell you a little bit about the process of getting there from an academic point of view. So I'm not a business person. I am not excited or too excited by the business aspects of creating a startup, and I resisted creating a startup for a while because people were using our product, and after they start using our product, our portal at the university, very often they would come up to us and say, hey, I need this in my lab, and I cannot share my samples with you. Can I have a commercial product out of this? And we're like, no, you know, this is our little Frankenstein type of tool where we test our thing. If you want to use it, it's free, but you know, we're not giving out, we're not making anybody pay. But if you want to send a gift to the university, we'll never say no. So with last time, we saw an opportunity to actually see our ideas work in the real world. And I would say that this for me was the number one driver in creating a startup. So let's see if the stuff that we're doing here can actually work out in a real world environment. And we found out that the answer most of the time is no, meaning that the real interesting research that you do that is pushing the limit and is do, you know, bit tainting on large binaries in order to, you know, track value at a perfect, you know, very fine granularity, well, that doesn't work. Doesn't scale, cannot be used, so forget it. So you have to find the right amount of trade-off between what actually works and scales with respect to your research. And you can still innovate. You can still find and bring out new ideas. And I think, you know, maybe it's there's a little not humble, but I think that Lastline actually did that, really try to bring to the, you know, sort of commercial world certain ideas that were very much researchy, quote unquote. And also we saw immediately by working in the real world the potential for interesting research topics. And actually what happened oftentimes is that we ended up working in real world environment and we would get research idea completely unrelated to what we're doing with Lastline, and we will go back to our lab and say, hey guys, there is this awesome idea. We saw that these people really have this problem. It's a real problem for them. So how do we do that? You know, an example was like looking at, I was at a customer and somebody said, well, our major problem is that people put out these web, these Android apps. They say, oh, you can, for example, buy on Amazon and save 50% if you use this app. And so that you go there, of course, it's malware, steal all your stuff, and you're screwed. And this problem, big companies have to continuously troll all the markets to find these applications that pretend to be somewhat connected to them and then steal their stuff, but it's real, it's not real malware. It looks legit, but it's not really, and it's a real problem. And it's very difficult to define and do research and find a solution to that. But let's go back to how we got there. So we had these prototypes. People love them, and they ask us to have a commercial version. And we said, oh, should we really make a commercial version of, you know, our research per se? And we say, not really. Let's try to keep our research separated from our in our entrepreneurial endeavor, but we will use all the lessons learned in running the systems, and let's start to create something similar. So our first thought was like, what is something that we can do that cannot be replicated by a large corporation 5 minutes after they see it? Because the main problem is that we can work, you know, for a small group can work on a great idea. But if then, you know, Cisco or Microsoft or Juniper can say, oh, nifty ideas. Let's put 15 engineers on doing that. Boom, and you're gone because they have the distribution. So you have to find the right product that will not be stolen immediately. And patent protection, in my opinion, doesn't work. So our realization was like, hey, we have a good way to find out what's bad out there. So our first product is like, we're going to continually monitor the internet, find all the bad places, and tell people, don't go there. We want to find all the bad neighborhood of the internet and prevent people from going there. We call that a reverse firewall. Instead of blocking the bad from coming in, we're going to block the people inside from going to bad. Nobody cared about the product. People didn't understand it. And when they liked it, they used it the wrong way. And so we decided, okay, this is not working. We don't have enough customers. Let's make sure that we not only use this threat intelligence, what we call it, and the right way, but also we enforce that ourselves on the customer network. And so we, what we call technically pivot, and changed our product. So in order to do that, we needed money. So in 2009, when we started, we had no money. In 2011, after working for stock, we found angels that gave us almost $1 million, which allows us to bring people in with salaries. In 2012, we did what we call a convertible note. It's fundamentally a loan for $3 million, more or less, that allow us not to go for a round of funding for a little more so that we had some sales and we could have a better valuation and give out less of our, you know, company for money. And then we did two rounds for $10 million each. So more or less we got so far $24 million in money that we are burning and creating a hole in the economy for. And it's interesting to see that all this money had different, very different goals. And, you know, not all the startups are the same, but this is very, very typical. You got first million because somebody crazy said, you might actually end up doing something interesting. Here it is. Funny story. We got $900,000 because we were pitching to this angel funding person, angel funder. And at the end of the pitch, I said, yeah, okay, I'll do it. And he said, $900,000. I say, and we say, why? Why $900,000? I say, because you have it on the slide. And so we just put that number there. That was, we saw it were casual, but actually that ended up, so be careful about what you put on your slide. We could have done more. So the lessons learned, I don't want to bother you with all the details. For one thing that was incredibly useful for us was to have one person, his name is Klaus Schauser, that was behind us through the whole process. He's a ex-professor at UCSB that did Citrix, what has become Citrix Online, GoToMeeting, GoToMyPC. So he did a company, sold it, was successful, and he's also understood what it means to for a professor to be involved in a company. Having him behind us was so priceless that I suggest find that person if you decide to do this. Then the other important thing was figure out the intellectual property. After the Netscape debacle with the University of Illinois, definitely every investor is like, oh, you're from the university, you're a pariah, you stink, you're full of bugs. So unless you prove to me that you're absolutely free from every germ that comes from the university, I will not give you a single dime. And that was the most important thing. And once you do that with one investor, everybody else will just, you know, checklist it. So it's very important you get it right the first time. And then the other thing is, I must say, and maybe it's obvious, but to me it wasn't, it's the founding team. So we have three founders, but actually, if it was just me, Chris, and Angin, true, we wrote code at the beginning and all that, it was this other individual that I mentioned here that actually made the company successful. These are ex-students, ex-postdocs, and if you look at the affiliations for, you know, these are all people that work with me or Chris or Angin. PhD students that finished, and these became our main engineers in the company, and now each of them, you know, has several engineers under them. But these are the people that you need to have. Cannot start with mercenaries. You have to have the heroes, the ones that will say, yeah, you're paying me crap, and I barely see the end of the tunnel, but I will stay in on a Saturday night to do that. I cannot, to me, this is the major lesson learned. You go as a group. If you don't have these people that really don't care about money, because in Silicon Valley is really brutal, you will not be able to make it. And I'm almost finished. Don't believe the hype. Get away from fads. They're just that, fads. It's funny. We were big on market validation, and we found out to be completely useless. Understand the process. There is a book that I really liked. I've read a lot of books about startups. This is the only one that lays down the basic idea, understand your stock option and all that stuff. It's really important in the end when you get screwed. Trust people. They are trustworthy. It's always funny when you're talking to somebody that is a business person, quote unquote, and say, wow, can you put that in writing? And say, let's have a Skype call. Say, no, we have a Skype call, but can you put that in writing? I don't know, let's talk on Skype. Yeah, but you just promised something to me. Can you put that in writing? And the third time they say we have a Skype call, run away, because they're lying sacks of something. A rude awakening, selling is everything. It's better to sell a mediocre product than not to sell an awesome product. I know that for us, we're all proud of our technology. It's our baby. It's awesome. That's crap. If you don't sell, you don't have the money coming in. If you don't have the money coming in, the VCs will not give you the money. So an awesome product that sells, of course, it's the best. But if I have to choose between a product that's but sells, at least a little bit, and an awesome product that you cannot find one customer for, go for the first. It's not in our DNA, but it's important to realize that. The other thing that I realized, we are always very, because we come from this community, if I have to say I don't like Patrick's research, I'm really punctual. Say, you know, I think that you made a mistake here. You cannot scale this particular algorithm. In the real world, what I was shocked about, people lie. Just say, no, you know, Giovanni's product is pizza. It's like, no, it's not pizza, it's a risotto. No, it's pizza. It's like, but look, yeah, I don't care. I lie. I will lie to you. I will say that you do things that you don't do. People lie in a way that we in this community don't understand. I was like, the first time I was like, you just told a lie. I can prove that it's wrong. I don't care. And this is, yeah, I was laughing. It's like, this is ridiculous. Yeah, I don't care. I went to your customers and I told them a lie. So, but we could sue you. Oh, I don't care. The other important thing, and so one thing that I think it worked really well for us is that we're academic and we played it so much. Say, hey guys, everybody else has a lot of marketing, and say, you know, our problem, it's science. Okay? It works. And we can prove it. Okay? So we play that a lot, and it worked really well. So I think that we are a great candidate for startups. It's a great adventure. It makes you love research even more because you realize how, you know, great research is once you have to deal with customers. The founding team is the most important thing. And also, I don't know if humbleness is a word, but, you know, realize that you don't know business. Find help. And also, realize that one thing that I found out is that you go out there and you realize as an academic, you are a better problem solver than most people out there. You always have, you know, I mean, I had a lot of uncertainty. Oh my, these guys develop, you know, systems that are sold for billions. How do they do it? And then you look at their code and it's like, it's crap. I mean, it's really crap. It's really bad. And then you realize, wow, I mean, our, you know, Frankenstein prototypes actually weren't that bad. So, and keep your eyes open for the sharks. That's the only, I surf, so I do that all the time. So, I have questions. Before the question, always remember, this is what we care about as scientists. That's what the customer cares about.
All right, great.
Here, let me just, I can bring it in. Right.
Excellent.
Good to be with you this morning. I know we've changed the schedule. Before I get started, as
Jeremy mentioned, I had the honor of serving at the National Science Foundation for about 3.5-4 years before going back to academia. And for my part, I wanted to thank Jeremy and also my colleagues at the National Science Foundation, many of whom who come from the community, as our colleague from MPS just mentioned. And they come and serve honorably, and they go back to their home academic institutions. And of course, there are a number of colleagues at NSF who are permanent employees of federal government. I have to tell you, having served in a position that Jim Cruz is just starting to serve on, it gave me tremendous insight into the work that they do behind the scenes and the complexity of the job, and also the work that they do on behalf of the community. For that part, let's thank all of them for the work that they do. It's really good to be with you, and it's always hard to follow Giovanni on any kind of a speech or discussion, but I'll do my best. And I'm going to start by, first of all, saying a couple of words about the concept of innovation, and then share a story with you about how I started Arbor Networks with some of my former students, how we launched it and eventually was acquired, and then a few lessons learned. I understand we have to fill about 3.5 hours of gap this morning.
That's
right. So I'll go really slow. No.
If you can tap.
So it was Steve Jobs who said innovation, and I'm not saying invention, innovation distinguishes between a leader and a follower, and that's a very insightful comment. Clearly, Apple has demonstrated that. But my favorite quote about innovation is from actually Sid Caesar, the comedian. And he said, the guy who invented the first wheel was an idiot. The guy who invented the other three, he was a genius. Think about it for a second. What we're really getting at when we talk about innovation is really not about building things that are amazing. And Giovanni is right about the fact that as scientists and engineers, we take tremendous amount of pride in what we invent, in the artifacts that we create. The truth is you have to build something that somebody has a use for, and equally important, somebody is willing to pay you money for it. If you're talking innovating and taking your ideas from lab to practice to commercialization. So when we talk about the concept of innovation, we're also not talking about, and this is really extremely important, particularly for those of us in the high-tech business and in the technology business, we're not talking about just inventing things that have not been invented before from a technology or a product point of view. In fact, if you look around, many of the successes that you see, that you point to, it's not just the product or the technology, it may actually be an innovation that complements your product through an innovation in a process, in service, or a business model. Think about Zipcar as an alternative to ownership in urban areas. Think about Amazon as a disruptive new business model. Of course, they've done tremendous amount of innovation in the process, but at the same time, they've created a disruptive business model that has essentially transformed bookstores, commerce, and so on. And think about Southwest Airlines' service model, which is low fare, no frills, at least it used to be, in regional markets versus the hub and spoke model of full service national airlines. And these could be potentially sustaining or disruptive innovations. Now, let me take you back to about 10, 15 years ago and share with you some stories about the imminent collapse of the internet. By the way, I borrowed the next 10 or so slides, and I'm going to go through them very quickly. I have not modified them. These are vintage slide 2000, 2001, and you'll see the animation in a moment, and you see why I'm saying that. So all the ones with the green bar on the side, they're vintage 2000. I took the slide literally that we used when we were launching the company and so on. So the work that led to the formation of Arbor Networks actually did not come from our research in cybersecurity. It actually came from our research in BGP routing and traffic measurement back in the late 90s. And at that time, in fact, our group at University of Michigan was known for the work that it had done at major exchange points in the backbone of internet, studying the routing and stability of internet, which was leading to the collapse of essentially routes and so on, and had done studies, fairly profound studies, of measurement of the backbone of internet and trying to essentially to get an understanding of how traffic flowed across the entire internet and also some of the routing issues and so on. So that was the context and the history of the group, which at the time had absolutely nothing to do with cybersecurity or the work that led to formation of Arbor Network. Now, back to the story about the imminent collapse of the internet. Well, every few years, if you're in the business of networking or cybersecurity, you see that, I don't know if you could see the line, yeah, you can. Doesn't matter what year it is, and this was year 2000, people predict it, and it doesn't really matter what's on the y-axis, as it turns out. It's totally irrelevant. People would predict the imminent collapse of the internet, and there were different reasons. In fact, in the mid-90s, when we were working on the routing stuff and traffic measurement and traffic analysis, it had to do with the complexity of routing and, in fact, had to do with topological complexity of the internet at the time, and the amazing amount of traffic that was being generated comparing today is absolutely nothing, but, in fact, the challenges with routing traffic across the internet. Well, fast forward to 2001, at that point in time, the imminent collapse of the internet was going to happen as a result of denial of service attacks. Many of you in the audience remember this. That was threatened availability of the internet infrastructure and services. And here's my vintage circa 2000 slide with the animation that's coming, just building a little bit of suspense here. That at the time, there was no commercial products available to effectively protect government and commercial networks from distributed cyber attacks. And at that time, remember, there were these very, very visible, essentially, internet attacks launched against CNN, Whitehouse.gov, Citi, eBay, you name it, and so on. And the way it worked out, all of you know this in the audience, of course, but this was for VCs, as it turns out, that there are a bunch of machines that are compromised. Eventually, they launch attacks through AT&T, MCI, which no longer exists, Comcast, and so on. They go through. There's a high-value target. Pick your favorite target. They saturate, at the time, the DS3 line, and so on. Would you like to see the animation again? Okay. All right. Here it goes again. Zombie machines, launch attack, bang. There it is. All right. It's fantastic animation, isn't it? All right. Good. So, and this was real. This was really. People were very stressed about the fact that there was imminent collapse. It's interesting that we continue to talk about these issues. Well, the fact is, behind the scenes, the problems were much more severe because internet service providers, and our experience of our research group was primarily with internet service providers, not with the enterprises, and I'm going to come back to talk about the business model in a moment, is that the internet service providers were actually getting attacked, not just their customers who were screaming because their customers were going offline, but the actual infrastructure of the internet service providers were being attacked at the time. What a lot of people didn't know, what happened is that they were bringing down routing infrastructure, they were bringing in essentially services and so on across the internet, across the service providers. That was the reason they cared. Now, remember, a denial of service attack meant at the time more bandwidth, which meant you could actually charge your customers more money. It's actually not a bad thing for an internet service provider to be dealing with an internet service attack. The fact that their customers were being taken offline, it was okay. It just was a lot of bandwidth that the customers had to pay for, and they charged the customers. But when it impacted their own infrastructure, it mattered. So one of the fundamental observations, and a number of colleagues here actually who were around at the time were looking at the same problem, was that this problem did not matter to the internet service providers, not because their customers were screaming, but also because their infrastructures were under attack. And of course, AT&T, the impact of the attack was on its service providers, on the actual targets like Amazon and Citi, and of course on the subscribers, because this is pre-essentially worms taking over and pre-essentially botnets, but right at the time where botnets were taking off, early days of worm and botnets, that home essentially subscribers were being used in these attacks, which is now commonly accepted as something that happens every day. Now, the major observation was that most people who were developing, including academia and outside, technologies for dealing with denial of service attack, and that this may come as a surprise to you, is that they were essentially developing a point device that would sit in front of the target to protect the target against an attack. So it was a point solution sitting at the edge of the network. Well, now it may seem obvious, but at the time, The idea was that somehow you built, call it a fancy firewall or whatever, or intrusion detection system and mitigation. The challenge here was the same way you could bring down any high-value target at the end, you could bring down actually that point device. So we were who were coming from actually more of a networking and routing background looked at this and said, no, you got to cut off the traffic much earlier upstream away from the target. Otherwise, this problem is not solvable. So it was not a point solution. It was a distributed solution. This is, of course, 10, 12 years ago. Shifting monitoring data collection to sensing devices. Separation of control plane and data plane, which is now has become, particularly in SDN and so on, a common practice, anomaly detection and so on, based on traffic sampling and clustering of flow traffic and so on. Here comes another animation. So again, this was done to show to VCs that it actually worked. So imagine you have service provider A, service provider C, service provider B in the middle. The firewalls are sitting there. There's a high value target sitting in the corner. There's a denial of service attack is being launched. What we do is you profile and monitor the traffic, the standard anomaly detection. There's, of course, a lot more complex. There's a lot more math involved. There's a lot more interesting stuff behind the scene. Dynamically profile, identify essentially, create these accurate models of what's normal traffic. During essentially an attack, you detect it, but you don't try to essentially mitigate it in front of the high traffic, high value asset. You essentially identify a signature, push it through the service provider network to the peering points, and then use various kinds of routing and other techniques to do the backtracing, and then try to cut it off at essentially the exchange points at places that you actually have ability to do it. So here's another one. To show you again how this works, this is profiling, this is the detection, this is the backtracing, and then you filter it and everything is happy, life is good. There are many key concepts, I'm going to skip over them because this is not a technical presentation, but equally important was the concept of BGP off-ramping and re-injecting back into the network. Now just imagine for a moment that you're trying to off-ramp traffic in a service provider network like AT&T, clean it up and re-inject it back into the network. From a scientific and engineering point of view, this is a very, very hard problem. It's a very, very tough problem that had to be solved. So there is a lot of great, essentially, work, science and engineering that had to happen behind the scene to actually make this a reality. To Giovanni's point, in a lab environment, you can demonstrate these and these work, and of course, it's great. But trying to do this in a service provider network is a non-trivial effort, in particular that these are very, very demanding customers. So what happened to from the research to commercialization? From 95 to 99 was all the traffic monitoring routing. This work was funded by DARPA, NSF, Cisco, Intel, and others. In 99 and 2000, Doug Mann at DARPA funded actually some of the technology transfer work that we were doing. In summer of 2000, we launched the company. Over a two series of round of funding, we raised $33 million from the East Coast and the West Coast and a bunch of strategic investors, which I'm happy to tell you about the role of strategic investors like Cisco and Comcast and SAIC. The company was launched in 2001. By mid-2003, a bunch of customers, national service provider networks, Defense Department, and so on, big customers. Notice that the company that was launched was not trying to serve the enterprise market. It was servicing, actually, the internet service provider market and the telcos and the cable companies and so on. That was a fundamental business decision was made not to go after enterprises, the business model to go after the service provider, sell the solution to the service providers who protected their network, and over time, they offered that service actually to their customers. In fact, AT&T's denial of service protection service is based on this very solution. So we raised our Series A in 2000 during the hype of the 2000 dot-com boom, the valuations were great. We raised our Series B when everything went down in the toilet and everything collapsed. We didn't have to do a down round, but here's another thing. You raise money when you see the market going sour, you hoard it, and you try to essentially preserve it for as long as you can to ride essentially the downturn. But everything worked out, raised $33 million. And I'm going to give you a snapshot of the company at the time it was acquired, because now that it's part of a public company, it's not appropriate for me to comment on the company. At the time that it was acquired in 2010, the business headquarters was based in Boston, the R&D headquarters in Ann Arbor, over 300 employees, most of the R&D team in Ann Arbor, At the time, 80% of Tier 1 and 60% of Tier 2 service providers were customers of Arbor Network. And just a snapshot of the customers across the world, this is in 2001, it's grown actually significantly beyond that. You see major concentration in North America, in Europe, and in Asia Pacific. Just an anecdotal evidence of this, because these are not enterprise customers, these are service providers and big, essentially, content delivery networks and so on. At the time, our estimates were that 70% of the internet transit traffic essentially was being monitored by this. A few lessons, if I can take 5 minutes on some of the lessons learned. So 70% of the traffic at the time was being, and then the company was acquired by a public company, and it's been spun off again and so on. But if you go online, Arbor Networks lives as a standalone company because it's a wholly owned subsidiary. And it was a transaction that happened about 3-4 years ago. Now, a few lessons. One of the most important lessons here is that the new ideas and concepts that were funded by the original research from National Science Foundation, from DARPA, and some industry partners, we totaled it, it must have been to the tune of not more than $6 million of research funding over a 3-4 year period that led essentially to the commercialization of technology. But immediately after that, within the following 3 or 4 years, we raised about $33 million that went into the commercialization. There is just a rough figure for software and technology business. For hardware, it's actually much more. For drug companies, it's orders of magnitude more. But you really are looking at an order of magnitude more funding that has to go into actual commercialization. Because we know the prototype works, but when you have to essentially deliver it to a customer that it works in an operational setting, it really requires you for essentially to rewrite the damn software from scratch. You do it 2 or 3 times, as Giovanni would tell you. In his case, maybe more. In our case, many, many times more. And that. The second thing is that infrastructure security technology based on the original government research is currently deployed across the world. The point Giovanni made that very much resonates with me is that it gets to a point where if you're thinking the way a lot of the folks in the West Coast think about it, in terms of how much money I'm going to make, you're going to be miserable. You really have to approach this because you're academics. And as academics, you have to approach it because you believe in the impact of the research and the impact of the technology. And if as a result of it, you make a bunch of your former students rich in the process, God bless you, go for it. And if you make a bunch of VCs rich, that's a side effect. But then the economic development part of it that happens as part of that, a number of you in the audience actually have tremendous experience with this, is just as important as the deployment of the technology and so on. The research impact can be seen in many ways. Obviously, is the cool stuff you've come up with and you get it deployed and it gets used by a lot of people, sure. But the other part of it is that you create a lot of jobs in the process. And do not ever underestimate the importance of that and the importance of that from a research point of view and also from our academic mission in our home institutions in terms of a regional. And this has become a very important theme in many academic institutions. Now, a few challenges and surprises during the process. It's really funny because when you talk to VCs and you talk to people who want to give you money, they all talk about due diligence. I don't know how you phrase it, but it's really bullshit. So it's complete nonsense because what happens is that they all drag their feet. And a number of you actually in the audience have experience with this. I know Stefan Savage has experience with this and a number of others. They all talk about due diligence. The truth is the minute somebody gives you money, suddenly everybody thinks it's a good idea. They're going to rush to give you money. So the trick is to create that competition and get that. But there's also an inflection point that you have to be aware of. On one hand, you want to hang on as much equity in the company as you can. But the truth is that if you don't take money early enough, you may be killed by competitors. On the other hand, if you take money too soon, then you're not going to raise money at an inflection point where the valuation of the company is going through the roof. If you look at what Uber is doing, which is fairly successful, is that they have found an inflection point at which point they have raised their money and they're done remarkably well. There was tremendous amount of pressure to move to the East Coast or West Coast. We were based in Ann Arbor. I'm happy to elaborate on that. There's a lot of lessons in that, which I'm sure my colleagues who don't live on the West Coast or East Coast, primarily in the Bay Area or Boston, can share with you. We as technologies and researchers have a very technology-centric view of tech transfer. Now that I have served as VP of Research at Carnegie Mellon, I can tell you that It was true at Michigan. It was true at a number of academic institutions where I served at NSF and I interacted with them. It's absolutely true at Carnegie Mellon. Is, as researchers, this is, of course, what you would expect. We believe that our cool idea or the innovation that we come up with is the most important piece. That's the piece that really, really matters. The truth is that when you step back and look at commercialization, a cool idea or innovative technology is a small piece of the part of the picture. Innovators and administrators in universities tend to underestimate what it takes to commercialize research technologies. Investors don't invest in just your ideas or your patents, far from that. They actually invest in people, so you have to figure out the balance. And of course, my co-founder, who was my former student, Rob Mallon, used to say, the business model is very simple. You build it, you sell it, the rest of it is overhead, and there is a lot of truth to that. But the paradox of innovation is that you have to go into it with a lot of conviction. When we were applying many of the solutions that we came up with that had to do with routing, with had to traffic measurement and monitoring and so on to a network security problem, we really didn't understand the implications of it. We really didn't understand. We kind of had an idea that this was a right way to go. But no one knows how an invention will impact the world unless it's widely used, leading to unintended consequences. A couple of last slides. Knowledge creation and dissemination is, of course, happens in many ways. Students that we produce, publications, scientific journals, faculty advising students, and so on. Licensing patent and technology and software is another model, and very few of these things actually lead to seed technologies that lead to startups. So when we talk about technology transfer, I urge you not to disregard the fact that the most important product that we produce are students, and those have the most important impact on the world. The final comment about commercialization in universities, as universities transfer technology, there's a little bit of a misconception, but I think the world is changing. We transfer to commercial sector for public benefit. And I think there is now an attitude shift in academic institutions recognizing that there's a significant gap between research prototype and general availability of a solution. The qualitative impact on an institution is you're enhancing your faculty's student reputation, enhancing your national visibility of the institution, supporting your academic mission. Often, universities exaggerate the direct financial benefit to a university. Many universities, including Carnegie Mellon and my former home institution in Michigan, have very, very progressive licensing policies. If your home institution doesn't have it, you have to get in front of it and get the university to see that they need to change it. In fact, Arbor Networks, coming out of University of Michigan, was the very first company that was ever launched out of Michigan with only equity stake in it, not royalty. Because a royalty-based deal will most likely kill your company. It will impact the way you're going to raise money, and it will most likely damage your fundraising and kill your company. I'm happy to elaborate on that. And then the final thing about this is that we often overlook that the real benefit to the university happens in two or three ways. One is your former students or faculty members who get rich and come back and give money to the university. The regional and national impact as a result of economic development that happens around it. Many of academic institutions outside West Coast and East Coast are beginning to see this, certainly in the Midwest and the South, and increase in sponsored research. The final point is that we have seen a shift in thinking in technology transfer out of academic institutions over the last decade. Technology transfer from universities is not about protection of intellectual property that's created in our research laboratories. Far from it. It's about knowledge dissemination. It's about economic development. And most importantly, it's about societal benefit. It's about making our universities play a central role in the innovation ecosystem. Thank you very much.
At this point, I'd like to open up the microphones to questions, and I'm going to start off with one. I heard hints of this in both of your talks. One of the most common things that I hear when I talk to folks about commercialization is they say, well, if you do this and you want to be successful, you have to move typically to the valley. Neither one of you, I don't believe, own real estate in that area. I guess you'd have to rent, technically. But how true is this, and how did both of you avoid doing that?
So it is, in our case, it was very true, and we didn't avoid it. So actually, our headquarters are in the valley. We resisted as much as we could because we We didn't want to be part of that particular market for engineering, but it's important for business. So the first time we got our Series A, it was almost a condition, you're going to have an office somewhere in the Bay Area, and that's it. So it was not, but we kept all the engineering in Santa Barbara, which allows us to have an insanely low turnover. So I think we lost one engineer in our history, and it was after 2 weeks because we realized we couldn't work together. Everybody else stayed on and was happy. And this is very difficult to achieve in Silicon Valley, where you're continuously poached by other people around you. If you're in Santa Barbara, first of all, Santa Barbara is not that bad. But then it's not that crazy of a market. So you can still be, you know, receiving offers, but it's not as crazy. But for management, I think you need to be there. I think it's, oh, you don't need to be there, but it helps, obviously. It's just a location thing.
So I echo what you said, Giovanni. What happened in our case is that our lead investors were either in the Bay Area or in Boston. So the immediate question was, well, when are you going to leave the Midwest, Ann Arbor, and come and just do this? And that became kind of a condition for doing the investment. So what we did is we argued the following case. And at that time, remember, you have a crazy professor, a couple of graduate students who are asking for $12 million to launch a company. By the way, if anybody gives you $10 million to launch a company, go do it. Don't worry about it. It's somebody else's money, I guess. But more seriously, what we did in the process, excuse me, was that I made a deal with the investors that we will keep the engineering team in Ann Arbor. And if we, there was a real concern whether we could grow it to 100, 200, 300 people. And we made the deal that if we reached a ceiling such that we can't hire in a college town, then we would move it to Boston or somewhere else. So we kept the business team actually in Boston. And it made a lot of sense because many of our, not only the lead investor, but also many of the customers, the service providers, were in the Northeast Corridor, as it turns out. But kept the engineering team in Ann Arbor. And it turns out, after about a year, it became a non-issue. In fact, the latest thing was that the Ann Arbor site itself has about 300, 400 engineers that are actually, it's an intellectual core of the company actually remains in the Midwest. But you have to make that deal. The next company I do, there'll be a different negotiation will take place. But you will be under tremendous pressure to move the company, and sometimes you have to do it. But if you can get away with not doing it, I think in the long run, you'll be happy, and your spouse may actually be happy with you as well.
And I have to add one thing that actually, in my experience, separating the business part that goes to the Bay Area or wherever from the engineering group, for some people may seem like a flaw or detrimental to the company. I think it actually helps because oftentimes the business part goes a little crazy and start interfering with engineering, and you want to shell your people from, you know, the Dilbert marketing crazy situations that will eventually arise because your marketing people are well-meaning, but eventually they're going to do something crazy that, you know, you're not supposed to do. So separating, it's good, also geographically.
So I'm going to go ahead and take a question from Mike. Please do me a favor and identify who you are and where you're from.
Sure, Ari Trachtenberg from Boston University. So I've worked with a number of companies trying to push research into their interests, but I've never tried a startup, largely because I like doing research and teaching. What are the relative benefits of actually starting up a company rather than trying to find an existing industrial partner that can take a lot of the stuff that I don't really want to do?
That you learn the stuff that you don't really want to do. So I think it's the learning experience, I think it's amazing. And seeing every piece of the puzzle from day one, it's really an amazing trip. I mean, an amazing journey, I would say. You'll find out if you really don't like it that much. Maybe you become a serial entrepreneur. You never know.
You know, I guess I would add to that most of the time you shouldn't actually launch a company because a lot of times we think that we have a cool thing that we've developed, but it, honestly, it's not a company. It's a product or it's potentially a service. So in that case, it makes a lot of sense to work with industry partners and get it out the door that way
Because when you talk about the company, I mentioned that how we went after the service provider as opposed to the enterprise market. That, in hindsight, it was a brilliant decision, but honestly, we backed into it. If you go after the enterprise market, you have to develop a sales channel, which costs you an enormous. The reason Cisco is successful is because they sell 20,000 products, and they have salespeople who go and can, you know, sell any of these products. But if you have a company that has one product, building a sales channel to do this, it's an almost impossible task. So you have to develop sales channels and build a model around it, which makes it very hard. Whereas that product, you may be able to essentially take it through an established company, be enormously successful, avoid many of the pains that you talk about, but do it. So I actually favor that model. But every once in a while, if you have an idea that you believe is worthy of becoming an independent company, take the plunge.
Thanks. Good morning. Vaughn Welch from Indiana University. First of all, thank you for a great set of talks. I want to ask a question. Giovanni, you made this great point about a mediocre product that sells is better than a perfect product that doesn't, or a great one. Given the fact we come from a security mindset, most of us in this room, and we often lament the lack of security in products we see out there generally, not picking on yours, did you have any lessons learned from a business perspective worrying about the security of your products as you were pushing them out and making that trade-off of, you know, getting to market versus being perfect?
Yeah, I think that if you do a security startup, you live with a bunch of paranoids. Jeremy was talking about leaving the laptop. We have this shark rule in our company that at any time, if you leave your laptop unattended, somebody can sit on your laptop and will send to the whole company shark pictures or say, I love shark, or in some cases, you know, inappropriate content posted on Facebook. It happened. And this, you know, when I say an imperfect product, it's not because it has, you know, flaws. They say, oh, okay, well, you know, if somebody can SQL inject my you know, code, I don't care. It's more about sometimes people want a perfect product that will do everything that one person has in mind. Sometimes you would be surprised. They say, well, but does your, you know, thing analyze Flash, you know, object? Well, we don't. Well, but your competitor does. Yeah, well, go to the competitor. We do everything else much better. So it's not perfect, but eventually sells. And thinking about the perfect product and working so hard to have something that you are, you know, ready to send out in the world can be really a stopper, because we're all a little, I think that if you're a professor, you're somewhat a perfectionist. And so if you wait for your product to be totally awesome, first of all, you will not learn from deployment, which is a very important part. And also you will lose the wave and you will become irrelevant very fast. So it's not about a trade-off in security. We care about that.
Robert Dick, University of Michigan. How did you deal with investor concerns about important co-founders having academic positions, not giving those up to focus on the company entirely?
That's a terrific question, Robert. I think you have to have at least a couple of co-founders who are going to go with the company. And you know my story from Michigan, that I actually took a leave from the university for a couple of years, and my home institution was very accommodating to give me a leave, 2 years of leave of absence and a year of sabbatical to actually leave the company, leave the university. The only thing that I maintained was the PhD students who were in the pipeline. I had committed to them, so I worked with them whenever I could, mostly on weekends, to get them through. But beyond that commitment, the university really gave me the opportunity to leave the company, to leave the university to do this. And it was really great because that was really the only way we could raise money and have the commitment. I think if you don't have a couple of the co-founders who are willing to do that, it's almost impossible. On the other hand, it's not uncommon for the faculty advisor to have a part-time appointment in a company and eventually return to the university. I had every intention of coming back to the university, but at the time, although I didn't take the CEO title, I actually ran the company. I did the Series A round of funding with my collaborators and the Series B before we hired the first CEO of the company. And I think that lesson was important because it has set a culture for the company that we defined as co-founders. And that really required me to be with the company 24 hours a day for the first
2-3 years of it.
Were you blunt about the long-term plan of returning to the university after the company was... So, okay, you were going to get it started and then someone else would take over.
You know, there are two scenarios. One is the company does really well, and then you have the opportunity to go back, or company crashes, you go back. When it's sort of in the gray area, in the middle, that the investors don't want you to leave and so on, it makes it really tough. But I was very clear. In fact, the investors liked it, because the investors often deal with founders, academic founders and so on, is back of their mind they're thinking, when do I get the chance to shoot this person, essentially? Because they want to launch a company, and then the founders often get pushed out or taken out for a walk and they never return, and so on. So the way I aligned my interest with the investors was I had no ambition to be a CEO of a company and be with the company for the rest of my life. My goal was to make it successful, to have the impact, and go back to my day job, which was a university job. So they thought, the fact that they didn't insist on hiring a CEO on day one and let me, a college professor, sort of muddle through it and run the company for 2-3 years was astonishing to me. I would have not done that if I were them, but that's a different story. So I think if you show to them that you're serious about returning to your day job, but you're committed to the company for however many number of years, I think your interest and the investors' interest will be aligned. And that's what happened, at least in our case.
Dito. Yes, I agree. I fully agree. It's kind of a difficult path to navigate sometimes, but I think that we really, really made clear to the investors that our tie to the university and to research, even when it's not related to what we're doing, it's an enormous source of good people that we hire when they graduate, of ideas that might, you know, percolate from one end to the other. And they see the value, and they see that, you know, when we go and we say, yeah, we're, you know, professors, we actually implemented algorithms to do what we do, and it works, people seem to be responsive, and so they don't want us to lose that. So I think, you know, coercing into their minds the idea that being a professor is a good thing, it's not a bad thing, is the key factor in that.
Thank you. Nikita.
Nikita Borisov, University of Illinois. Great presentation. I had a question. So both of you keep using the word we, and I think in this case it's not an academic we. So can you tell us a little bit about how you approached forming this kind of founding team, and whether you look for something different in people who would start a company with you than when approaching building a team for a research project?
That's a fantastic question. I would say the most important thing is, I mean, for us, I mean, Chris, Engin, and I, it was like we love spending time with each other, and you know, we were not just colleagues, we're friends, and so this seemed like a fun thing to do, and that was fundamental. It was also clear from the beginning that we had to take different roles within the company, not to conflict. For example, at a certain point, both Chris and I were sort of driving the development group and keeping the roadmap or whatever. And we found out that that's suicidal because it's suicidal. And so, for example, Chris now has the roadmap. So if I have an idea, I have to go to Chris and say, hey, Chris, I would like really to do that. Can we put it in the roadmap? And he's the, you know, he has the one ring to rule them all, which is great because otherwise it would be conflict continuously. Regarding the people, the founding team, there are certain quality. They have to be, they have to enjoy building systems, at least in what we do, you know, because the first code that you write, it's so stupid, you know. I start writing a sniffer. I mean, you know how you know, and enthusiastically I did that. I mean, it's like, yeah, okay, I'm gonna write a sniffer, and I do this TCP reassembly, and blah, blah, blah. And there are people with PhDs, they're putting buttons on interfaces. So you need people that have both the mind to create innovation, and at the same time, from the very beginning, they understand that they're going to take out the trash, they're going to do the runs at Costco and buy the coffee and put the button on the user interface that nobody wants to do. I think that balance of understanding that there is no small job, but still understanding that we need really smart people and they need to be able to work together is key. Because I would go to Ludo, one of our engineers, ex-student of mine, and recently he had to fix some basic account of some salesperson, has to go on Google app, and I said, God, that is such a trivial thing to ask. He could do such more important tasks. But at that point, he was like, yeah, of course, I'll do it. And that's the type of people you want.
I would add to that that you should start a company with people that you would trust your children with. I mean that seriously. My co-founder, who's my former student, and I, who's only 5 years younger than me, that used to say that. You really have to have tremendous trust in your co-founders. And I think this is where most companies go wrong, is you start and then you realize that you can't actually work with this person because you have to divide responsibility, you have to read the other person's mind, you have to accept that 90% of the time you make the same decision and sometimes it's wrong, so be it. The part that I think most of us in the technology space get it wrong and get into trouble is you take money and then VCs or people who've given you money are going to come in and say, but you're a great researcher, you're a technologist, what we really need to have is to hire a marketing person and a salesperson and a CEO. And I've seen this happen, this movie play out over and over, is that it's not that I'm against having business people come into a company. Far from it. In fact, my argument is technology innovation and invention is a small part of it in terms of success. Of course, that's what really has to work, but the business side is equally important. The truth is that often you end up hiring someone from outside who's not necessarily a co-founder, but maybe a CEO, maybe a VP of marketing, maybe a VP of sales. And that's where you run into trouble because they don't understand the culture of the company, they don't understand the technology, and in fact, they don't mesh with the founders very well. And often the outcome, the end result is going to be that founders are pushed out. One or more of the founders. So I think the bigger risk isn't starting a company with your former students or collaborators because these individuals and you know the level of trust and so on. The bigger risk is the senior people that you bring on board almost immediately. And how, when do you have to do that and what is the appropriate time and are they the right people? Because you'll get people with great resumes who are articulate, who talk a great game, but do they actually understand the business the way you understand it and they can help you succeed at the company? One thing that we are told as technologists is that we don't have the business credentials and we really need the help from outside. To some extent, that's true, but my advice is trust your gut instincts because as it turns out, you may be the person who understands the market with a little bit of work and a little bit of study, understands the market better than anyone else that you would bring in from outside.
Hi, Salil Vadan, Harvard University. I was wondering if you touched on it in both of the talks a bit, but could say a bit more about how far the research prototype model can be pushed. So, how far one can go in terms of real-world impact and research lessons. So, money aside, research lessons learned from deployment with research prototypes that are freely and widely used by others. And at what point does that model start to get strained for what one wants to do, and one really needs to think about other models such as commercialization, either through industrial partners or through a startup. So kind of what's the sort of boundary of the research prototype model?
That's a terrific question. I think the boundary has become fuzzier and fuzzier, and the lines are more blurry than they used to be maybe even 10 or 15 years ago. I mentioned in my presentation that at some point, actually, Doug Mann at DARPA funded part of the technology transfer. And I've seen this actually at NSF, at Michigan, and now at CMU, is that we're funded to do our research. In fact, many of the people who are interested in working with us, especially in government, that let's say you want to deploy technology on a government network, they don't have the resources or the funding to actually do the deployment and to work with you. So the question is, how do you create that ecosystem that supports that? So smart program managers, when they have the discretion, actually recognize that, and I again give Doug Mon tremendous credit for that. He's now at DHS, as many of you know, for seeing that and saying some of the research funding could be used for us to work with, not to commercialize, to work with essentially real networks, whether it was service providers or government networks at the time, DISA, to deploy the technology to demonstrate. I think that was incredibly insightful of Doug, and it really impacted us. The more you do in a university, the better off you are in terms of the equity that you create that benefits you, your co-founders, and the university, and the better it is actually for the government as well, because the government actually has a tremendous role to play as a market shaper, I think we often underestimate that, not only in terms of investment in basic research, but the priorities, but also in terms of facilitating transfer of knowledge. Since I have the podium, I should put a plug in for NSF iCore, which my colleagues at NSF run these days, and that's a really innovative program. There are a number of other programs that have been created at NSF and other agencies that recognize that there is this gap, and you really have to fund people beyond research to do the commercialization. So iCore program, if you're not familiar with it, I strongly urge you to, is Anita here or did she leave? Oh, you're here, okay. Yeah. So it's a program you should definitely make yourself familiar with, and I'm sure Jeremy can tell you much more about it. There are a number of other programs at NSF that do this. I think there's recognition from federal agency that needs to be done. I think it's good for our community especially that that line has become more blurred.
Yeah, I want to just add, I totally agree with that, but I would add that there is with research, there is a problem of return on investment. If you're a system builder, for example, you know, I think about Vern Paxson and Bro, right? They put so much effort to do this, you know, amazing network analyzer, they were able to use it in so many ways to support different type of analysis and product. That makes sense, right? And so, because it takes a lot of work to maintain it, to make it, you know, continuously working, and they had, you know, in a way, a perfect setup, you know, the national labs and all that. For example, we saw with one of our systems, Anubis, we saw a return on investment going down because we were saying, okay, we're maintaining at UCSB tons of machines to elaborate this stuff, but is anybody really doing research using the Anubis platform? We find, well, not really. We moved to firmware analysis, binary analysis, Android analysis, and so we're always like, oh God, you know, the cloud just went down. Okay, who knows how to restart Anubis? And the people who could do it, you know, start disappearing. And suddenly we're like, oh wow, one day we're gonna have a blackout and we'll not be able to reboot this system. So I think it's super, I think that for us, the amount of stuff that we learn from making these prototypes either available in source code or as a portal was immense. But at a certain point, as a researcher, you have to move on. Otherwise, you lose so much time maintaining stuff that doesn't give you back anything anymore.
Jim Plasqualic, University of New Mexico. UNM uses a royalty-based model for their technology. And I was curious, you said that that was a killer, right? And can you elaborate on... Sure. Why that is and what the alternative would be?
Sure. I'll give you my take on it. You know, different businesses sort of require different kind of a licensing agreement with universities. Right. Let's suppose that you're working on a drug formula. Doing a royalty-based model for that is not a huge stretch, okay, because you could see that essentially what the product is, if you will, and you could assign a royalty to it. The challenge we have in our community, I mentioned that in fact, we started with network visualization, network monitoring, and so on, and BGP routing eventually moved into security. What I didn't tell you actually, in the early days, we weren't actually selling the security product very well. What happened is that most of the service providers would convince their bosses to pay money for this because it was a security product. But in reality, they actually wanted a traffic monitoring piece of it. That was much more helpful to them. And that continues to be the case. So your business model actually is not known at the time you're launching a company. Trying to create a royalty-based model means identifying the product and potentially all the derivative products from it that are going to get royalties.
Right.
And VCs and people who invest in the company, or is somebody who's going to come and buy the technology from you, they often balk at it. In fact, I see this in my current role, where companies that are interested in working with our faculty immediately ask me the question, what can we do to get a clean license for all the background IP and so on? Because we don't want to worry about a lawsuit 3 years down the road, or worse, is some derivative product that's going to be a huge success and then expected to generate royalty. So it's a deal killer. I shouldn't say it kills the company. It's really a deal killer. It undermines your business model. The equity-based model I like a lot, because what it says is, if the company does well, the university will benefit from that equity. And if the company tanks, university, all the IP reverts back to the university anyway. Mm-hmm. So it's a fairly clean model. Some universities, including CMU these days, have this sort of a 5%, somewhere between 5 to 10% equity model, where you essentially agree and you create a template such that any faculty member who wants to take their company out, they want to take it out. He or she just signs a piece of paper and the university gets somewhere between 5 to 10% equity, even very early stage, and then the university gets diluted like everybody else. And I think that's exactly the right model.
So the difference is really an investment in the company versus an investment in the technology.
Exactly.
Very interesting. Thanks.
We have time for two more questions.
Hi, Stephanie Shuckers, Clarkson University. My question was related to the last question. Can you talk about research that's funded by the federal government, where the intellectual property must be held? Can it must it stay with the university, or can it be sold to a company?
That's a great question. I'm just going to read you something that I had in my slides and I didn't get to. If you bear with me for a second, because I think there was an act called Bayh-Dole Act, which, if you're not familiar with, happened in the 1980s. And what it did is, it essentially has, it was in some ways transformative in the following sense. What it did is that Congress in the 1980s enacted the Bayh-Dole Act, that it was intended to promote the development of technologies that arise from federally funded research by permitting licensing agreement between research entities and for-profit companies. So what it did is it gave universities and research institutions title to government-funded inventions and charge them with using the patent system to encourage disclosure and commercialization of inventions. It's that simple. The government gets a non-exclusive rights to your technology, but you can do anything we want to do with it within reasons, with the technology that's created. What that does is, actually, if you think about it, doesn't matter whether you subscribe to the left or right side of the political spectrum, what it says is government cedes research funding. And as a result of it, things that come out should benefit society, should create jobs, and so on. And it removed one more barrier from that. So you have a clean title in most cases to do what you want to do, or your university does. Does that help?
So then does the university have the ability to then sell it if it was originally federally funded?
Yes.
Yes.
Absolutely. In fact, most universities
license it or sell it.
Most universities are generous such that they share the proceeds with the inventors. But universities can go ahead and essentially do a licensing agreement. And what's that?
It's not a sale.
It's not a sale, I'm sorry. It's
an exclusive, it could be an exclusive license forever, which is equivalent.
Thanks for clarifying.
So they can't full out sell it, but it can be an exclusive perpetual.
It could be exclusive and non-exclusive. And the exclusive really gives the company everything that they need from this, essentially.
Right. It would make the investors fine with it.
Right.
Excellent. Okay, thank you.
Our last question.
Thanks for clarifying.
Jesse Walker, Intel Corporation. It seems like it might be useful to have a few remarks from the other side of the fence. And I think most of these amplify some of the points you've been made. So I'm in Intel Labs, and our mission is to cherry pick technology from the research community and then target it toward products. within Intel and Intel partners in standards and that sort of thing. And the two points I'd like to amplify in your presentations are the following. The first is the most important point in technology is you don't know its value. You have an idea that it's important. And your most important tool to discovering what the value is your prototype or your proof of concept, which is going to be the center of your discussion with your potential consumers in trying to find out what is valuable here and how to position and target the technology for consumption. The second point I'd like to make is that the consumers of your technology do not have your expertise, and you don't understand their constraints either. So you have to have a marriage between you, the developer of the idea, and the consumers of it to work together to develop. You have to rewrite your code because you don't understand your constraints. You have to work with your customers because they don't understand how the technology works and how it's going to be used and that sort of thing. So I just wanted to add those points.
Thanks for your comment. You mentioned that your affiliation with Intel, I should say that now that I'm not in the government, let me just say this, that Intel actually has had for a long time most progressive policies toward working with academic institutions. It's a shining example of how private sector in our business, in our field, can work with academic institutions, often with no strings attached, and do a lot of essentially work with academics, which potentially benefits Intel and other companies. But Intel really is a great model for that I think other companies could learn from. Thank you.
Thanks.
Folks, with that, I'd like to thank both of our speakers for sharing their insight expertise and, of course, being very flexible with the schedule this morning.